Man, it's good to see the faithful this morning. I don't know how you took that, but anyway, yeah. It is good to see everyone. I know we have a lot of people out of town, and we miss them too, and we'll call them to repentance next Sunday. Now, for this morning, it is just time to celebrate. I'm excited about our time together this morning. It's a really interesting story, and but it's one that we don't go over very often. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. As we continue our study through the Gospel of Mark, and we've been in here for some time now, just kind of taking it piece by piece. But remember last week we talked about how Jesus has finally reached his destination, finally reached Jerusalem. He's been walking towards Jerusalem for half the book now, right? After Peter confessed Jesus was the Christ, he turned towards Jerusalem. He began that metaphorical journey towards Jerusalem, towards his ultimate crucifixion there, and he's arrived there. It's now Passover week, and so the city would have just been bustling with visitors and an activity in preparation for the upcoming celebration. The temple itself would have been just the hub of all this activity as the pilgrims streamed through its gates to make their sacrifices and to do their commerce. I mean, it was just almost a festival going on there. And it's really difficult for us to imagine what the temple would have looked like, what the temple would have felt like around something like that. The original temple, you may remember, was built by Solomon, David's son Solomon, and that had, of course, been destroyed back when Babylonians had come in and they'd taken the Israelites captive and carried them off into exile. The temple had been destroyed at that time. And then later, we have just a handful, the remnant, coming out of exile, and they get to go back home, and they rebuild the temple, though according to all accounts, it wasn't as splendorous, as glorious, as Solomon's original temple. And so we get up to, shortly before Jesus' time, Herod the Great comes into power. Yes, that Herod, the same Herod who tried to kill baby Jesus, that's his most notorious act. But Herod was a great builder. That's why he was called the Great. And his greatest project was he funded this enormous expansion of the temple complex. And it just dwarfed Solomon's temple. It was built over and around. And it was just enormous. It was even grander and greater than Solomon's temple by far. In fact, it was considered, it was the largest type of building like that in anywhere in the world at that time. It was all-encompassing from the walls all the way around. It encompassed 35 acres. 35 acres, just in this beautiful, grand, elaborate, highly decorated structure. And this huge, magnificent building stood for less than a century. Because when Rome comes in AD 70s, they utterly annihilate the heart of Judaism. They utterly destroy the temple. They tear down absolutely everything just 50 years after the death of Jesus. The only thing left out of that entire temple complex is one wall. It's called the Western Wall. It still stands in Jerusalem today, the Kotel. And that wall today is the most significant site in all of the world for Jewish people. It is the last standing remnant of the temple. There are some stones that have been tumbled down and everything else, but this is all that's left standing. And Jews from around the world will gather there to pray and to write notes to God and to place them in between these ancient stones of the wall. You can see them stuffed in there. Every so often a rabbi will commission, and they'll go in, they'll clean all of these notes out. But people just stuff them in there by the thousands and thousands. But why? I mean, why this great emphasis on this wall? Well, it's because they believe that the divine presence of God never left the temple. So if God was in the temple, that's where God lives, right? And everything gets destroyed except for this one wall, then that must be where God's divine presence is sort of especially felt. It's still infused in the stones of this ancient holy structure. Just as importantly, they believe that all prayers ascend to heaven through the Holy Mount. So it comes up out of this Holy Mount and through the temple and ascend to heaven. That's how prayers work in Judaism. And tradition holds that this site, that the Holy Mount, the Temple Mount, the site of the temple, was where God laid the foundation stone. Now, the foundation stone was like the first building block of all creation, and everything else in creation was built upon this one stone. It's also the site traditionally held where Abraham went up to sacrifice Isaac. It's also the site where Jacob had his dream of the ladder that ascended to heaven and saw angels going up and down. So there's all these ties to this particular site, this particular building, this particular structure that tie Judaism together. The temple wasn't just a place of worship like we think of church buildings today. It was the heart of their relationship with God. And even beyond that, it was the epicenter of creation. That's how important the temple was. So in Mark's gospel, Jesus has finally entered this all-important city as its rightful king. We talked about that last week, how he rode in on the young colt of a donkey and how that was really sort of an understated messianic entrance. And he's now come into the city as its rightful king, and it's both, for Jesus, it's both the heart of Judaism and it's also the heart of those opposed to Jesus. Remember all of the religious leaders who'd come out of Jerusalem, those are the ones who are against Jesus. So you've got all this tension built up. The rightful king enters the city. All the opposition is there. What's going to happen? So after building up to this momentous occasion for half the book of Mark, Jesus comes in and he looks around and then he turns around and leaves. I mean, it seems a bit anticlimactic, right? To say the least. But as it turns out, that's just the beginning of the Jesus saga in Jerusalem. And it sort of leads us to our story today. So Jesus turns around, he leaves Jerusalem, leaves the temple, goes out and he goes to Bethany. So the next day, as they were leaving Bethany, presumably heading back towards Jerusalem for the day, right? So as they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to find out if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves because it was not the season for figs. And then he said to the tree, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard him say it. What a beautiful, beautiful story. I mean, what a strange story, right? I mean, what is going on here? To this point in the gospel, Jesus has used his power. I mean, Jesus has this power that flows through him, but he's only used it for sort of restoring things that are out of joint. You know, calming storms, feeding the hungry, raising the dead, healing the sick, casting out demons. All these sorts of things are done by Jesus. That's what he uses his power for. But here, for the first and the only time, Jesus' power is used for a curse. So why is Jesus going around cursing anything but surely a tree? I mean, even stranger, why is he cursing a tree for not producing fruit when it's not the season for figs? That's even stranger to me. It's, you know, cursing something for doing what God made it to do, right? That's what it looks like to us. And those are all great questions. But Mark doesn't answer them, at least not yet. He never answers them directly, but he sort of indirectly answers them, and you're supposed to be able to read into that. What Mark does instead is to split this story, the story of the fig tree, into two parts. So you got the beginning story of the fig tree and the ending story of the fig tree, and then in between, you got a whole different story, seemingly disconnected story. It's the story that we also often call the cleansing of the temple. It's sort of like a sandwich. You got fig tree, temple, fig tree. And the only way to understand the fig tree is to interpret it in light of the cleansing of the temple. And the only way to interpret the cleansing of the temple is to sort of take it together with the fig tree. All that kind of has to be taken together. When you put it together, you get this entirely different meaning, one that we wouldn't get otherwise. So let's continue reading then. Here we are at the temple. This is a fresco that's this carved into the temple. It says, on reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple courts and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. The chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this, and they began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. There's the middle part. Now let's finish the sandwich here. In the morning, as they were going along, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots, got completely dried up. And Peter remembered and said to Jesus, Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered. Have you ever had something happen to you? Like just something weird or strange happened to you? And you're like, what was that all about? Why did this happen? It could be a strange conversation. It could be a really weird event. It could be all sorts of things. Not necessarily bad, though we might often find that an inconvenience or really just a disruption. It's just something strange. But then later, something else happens that sort of ties it together. And you can look back and say, oh, of course, that's why that happened, right? That happened so I could understand this. If that hadn't happened, if I hadn't gone through that, then this wouldn't have made any sense. But because that happened, this makes sense. You know, that's why my car broke down. So that when I passed this other person who was stranded, I would remember what it was like to be stranded and I would help them. Does that make sense? Right? Something like that. Well, that's sort of the way it is here with the story of the fig tree and the temple. You see, in the writings of the prophets, you go back to the Old Testament, and you get like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, the minor prophet, and on into the minor prophets, the fig tree was symbolic of God's judgment on his people. And Israel is depicted sort of like a fig tree. They're a fruit tree. God plants the fruit tree. God takes care of the fruit tree. The job of the fruit tree is to produce fruit, right? So Jesus looks at this fig tree, this symbolic fig tree, and it's like Israel. The Israel that God planted in order to produce fruit. And when in Israel did not produce fruit, God pronounced judgment. Right? You're not doing what I built you to do. You're not doing what I created you to do. Therefore, you're cursed. So Jesus looks at this fig tree, and it looks like everything is fine. It looks like everything is normal, right? It looks like it ought to be producing fruit. It's got the leaves out. Now, fig trees have actually two sort of productions, at least in this part of the world. The way they work is you get the leaves come out, and these buds that have been on there all along, they start producing fruit. They get come off, and later in the season, you get more figs that come in later. We're in that in-between time where they produced a crop of fruit. They're not producing anything. They produce another crop of fruit. But it looks like there ought to be fruit because it's all leafed out. Looks like it ought to be doing something. Everything's green. Everything's healthy. But you look closer and something's off. It's not the season for figs. And like that fig tree, everything looks healthy with Jesus. At a cursory glance, which is what Jesus did the day before. Remember, he walked in, he looked around, and on the surface, everything looks fine. Right? You got the temple activity, you got people going in to make sacrifices, you got the commerce going on out there. Everything looks like it ought to be good. Everything looked fine, but you dig a little deeper and you find out that something is off. That something is not right. Despite the appearance of religious activity, Israel was not producing the right fruit. In fact, Jesus might say it's not the season for temple fruit. It's the season now for something else. The time for temple fruit is past. It's time for a new fruit to begin. So Jesus' curse on the fig tree was the condemnation of a system of religion that had gone from what it was supposed to be, a universal beacon to all nations, to what Jesus calls a robber's den. He condemns it for looking like something that it's not. He condemns it for appearing to be religious, but not really. So instead of calling everyone to worship and love the one true God, the Jewish leaders had set up a system that was deliberately a roadblock to some people. Now, who's getting roadblocked here? Well, it says they were set up in the courts. The biggest court, once Herod expanded his temple, was this enormous area called the Court of the Gentiles. Now, you go through the Court of the Gentiles, and you could go, if you were a Jewish woman, you could go into the Court of Women. If you were a Jewish man, you could go into the Israelites' court proper. But the Gentiles, all they had was like this enormous foyer, for lack of a better metaphor. That's all they had. And so now they'd turned that one place that the Gentiles could come into a market, like a roadside religious flea market. Imagine trying to go to the one place you could connect with God, Walmart, on Black Friday in the electronics section. Right? Can you imagine? Like, I just want to have this moment's peace with God here. Whoa, what is going on here? But in the minds of the priests and the religious leaders, who cares? Nobody wants them here anyway. I don't care if you can't connect with God. You're not a part of our people. I don't care if you can't pray here. That's not the purpose. This building is not for you. It is for us. No one wants those people here anyway, so let's just use that unimportant space for something that we think is important, namely making money off of poor people. They didn't say it that way, and they may not have even thought of it that way, but that was the way it worked out in practice. Let's use the Gentiles' space for something we approve of, making money. Let's use it. We're going to use it for two specific purposes. One, everyone, when you come to the temple, you've got to pay a temple tax. And so you could just use the money in your pocket, but you can't use just any money. You have to specifically pay for it with a Tyrian coin. And that was not a coin in wide circulation out of the Roman Empire. So what would happen is people would come in, they were like, okay, I've got this much money from the region where I live. How much for this Tyrian coin that I need to pay my temple tax? And they would say, oh, and here's the money exchange rate. Like if you were to go to Canada or Mexico or overseas, you exchange American dollars for euros or francs or wherever it is you're going, right? Well, you had to pay your temple tax with this Tyrian coin, and they were charging a pretty exorbitant exchange rate for you to do that. Now, who's doing that? You've got individual vendors, but really the priests are the ones who are scraping the top. So you got money that way. And then secondly, you've got everybody who comes, they want to make a sacrifice, right? And there's only specific animals you can sacrifice. And if you're coming from a Jewish population that's kind of far off, well, look, traveling a long way with a goat can be pretty difficult. Or maybe you don't even raise goats. Or maybe you don't even have access to the right kind of goat. So what they would do is they would just journey to Jerusalem just like normal. They'd bring enough money. When they got there, they'd buy a goat. Then they could sacrifice this good goat. And those guys had set up there in the temple courts as well. So you not have only like bustling economic activity, you've got like livestock barn at the fair atmosphere. Really, really religious feeling, right? So they're making money off of these animals, which they're charging exorbitant rates off those too. So they're making money hand over fist on the basis of a religious festival. Now, to you and I, that's not that shocking because we live in such a money-driven economy that we're no longer shocked that people try to make money off of something we think is sacred. Like, even people who love America are not shocked that some people are trying to make money off of Fourth of July, right? We may love Independence Day for what it means that we got freedom, but really we don't care if you're trying to make a puck. And so it doesn't bother us if you have an enormous fireworks tent that's painted like the flag. You know, you might not even love America, but you have a flag-painted tent, you can sell some fireworks, right? So it doesn't bother us then, and it didn't bother them then, even though they would have said Passover sacred, you can use it to make your money. So Jesus, at just the right time, pronounces a judgment on this whole system of religious dealing. Jesus looks at it, sees it for what it is, and pronounces a judgment on religious appearances. He attacks a system that has made God the patron saint of its users. Calling this the cleansing of the temple, you and I would call it a cleansing of the temple. They would not have called it a cleansing of the temple. In fact, it was just the opposite. In fact, that's kind of Mark's point. Jesus doesn't cleanse the temple. Jesus messes the temple up. Jesus doesn't purify the temple by giving Gentiles access to the temple. Jesus is polluting the temple. He's inviting in these Gentiles to mess up our good Jewish system. So in the popular imagination, Jesus isn't purifying the system. He's muddying the waters. And the question that we have to ask ourselves this morning, because we're certainly not under a temple system, is which system do we ascribe to? Which path are we on? Are we conducting business as usual, the business of looking religious, dressing up on Sunday morning, looking good, getting out the door, bringing in your Bible, going back and being seen at the buffet, or I don't know, in your religious clothes with your Bible on your table and putting a checked in thing on Facebook. I don't know what it is that we do, but are we conducting business as usual, looking religious, the business of keeping up appearances, the business that keeps us in and others out? Or are we casting all of that aside in an earnest desire to encounter, meet, seek God? Are we basing our prayers not on a religious building or on a religious system, but on a God who can hear and respond to our prayers, even if that entire mountain on which the temple was built were cast into the sea? And that's what Jesus goes on to do. He starts teaching about prayer. He says, you know, the first thing he says is, have faith. Even Jesus knows, right? This whole temple is going to go away, and this whole temple goes away, then people are going to have nowhere to pray, and that's what they're going to be thinking. And Jesus says, no. Have faith. When your whole world is shaken and everything you know about religion is thrown aside, God is still there. And God still hears what you say, hears what you ask, and responds with power. So that even if you ask this whole mountain to be cast in the sea, God is strong enough to hear it without the mountain. So even when you can't pray at the temple, God is just as present. Even if you can't gather with the saints on Sunday morning because you have to work or you're sick or you're out of town or whatever that may be, even then, God hears your prayers. God hears your prayers when you're by yourself at home. He hears you when you're bustling at work. He hears you if you're in the electronics section on Black Friday at Walmart. God hears and responds to prayers no matter where we are, not because we have this special system, but because He is a special God, and He thinks you are special. This morning, we call for a time of examination, a time to look at ourselves, look at our motives. Why are we here this morning? Why are we in Christianity? Why are we a part of the Forest Mill Church of Christ? Is it so that we can look religious, or is it so that we can seek God? And if we can encourage you, strengthen you, offer up prayers for help for you, for forgiveness, for aid, we want you to know whatever we can do for you this morning, we want to do that. Won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?